I'm Terry Thornton, Curator of Education here at the Modern, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing lecture series, 10 lectures every season, and we are pretty far along in the season. We have two more to go. We end on April 21st with the artist Laurie Simmons. Next week, Senia Nahafi, Editor-in-Chief of Cabinet Magazine and Editorial Director of Cabinet Books, is here to speak on Gordon Mata Clark, who is, of course, represented in the Modern's current exhibition, Framing Desire, that I hope you've all seen. We are fortunate enough to have some new acquisitions by Gordon Mata Clark. So I've invited Senia to come and talk about an exhibition that he and his partner at Cabinet Magazine put together. He's curated a number of exhibitions and co-curated a number of exhibitions, including this particular project, which is titled Odd Lots, Revisiting Gordon Mata Clark's Fake Estates. And for this Tuesday evening, he will present the intricacies of Mata Clark's Fake Estates, which is a project that did not come to fruition due to the artist's death, and then Cabinet Magazine's 2005 response to that with an exhibition. It should be extremely interesting. I can't even emphasize enough how interesting I think this is going to be. I invite you to read more about it online. There's a description on the Modern's website, and then, of course, you can find anything on the internet, so explore as you will. And then most of all, I hope you can come back to get the full story next Tuesday. Tonight, we could not be more thrilled about the conversation planned between Mario Garcia Torres, J.D. Wittenberg, and Allison Hurst. Of course, Mario Garcia Torres is the artist featured in the Modern's upcoming Focus exhibition, which opens to the public this weekend, and is the reason for this Tuesday evening presentation. Mario is a conceptual artist based in Mexico City. He received an MFA from CalArts and has developed an impressive career with international acclaim for his ambitious, research-heavy, reflective work that addresses ways in which art and information are constructed over time as he examines, conflates, and reimagines conceptual art of the 1960s and 1970s, often focusing on stories less told or projects unrealized. For such work, Mario has been included in almost every major international show of recent years, including the Berlin Biennale of 2014, Documenta 13 in 2012, the Biennale de Sao Paulo in 2010, and the 52nd Venice Biennale in 2007. His work has been the subject of solo exhibitions in impressive locations across the globe, including Project Arts Center in Dublin, the Reina Sofia in Madrid, the Joan Miró Foundation in Barcelona, the Kunsthal Zurich, the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam, and most recently his solo exhibition at the Hammer Museum in LA, which just closed in January. J.D. Wittenberg is a native Texan currently living in Dallas. He has written music and performed throughout the DFW Metroplex for more than 15 years. Beginning with a band in high school, J.D. released his first album in college. His 2007 self-titled album, J.D. Wittenberg, was nominated by the Dallas Observer for Best Album of the Year in 2007. J.D. never intended to get involved in conceptual art until his friend, local gallery owner Aaron Cluley, put him in touch with Mario Garcia Torres. The work to be discussed tonight is the second project they have collaborated on, and they are currently discussing plans for their next collaboration. And, of course, I think you all know Allison Hurst, the Modern's own assistant curator, who is in her tenure, has brought us the likes of Focus Fred Tomaselli and Focus Jules de Balancourt, and now is responsible for the upcoming exhibition, Focus Mario Garcia Torres, and thereby is responsible for this presentation. So a big thank you to Allison and a warm welcome to Mario Garcia Torres and J.D. Wittenberg.
Mario, I wanted to first start off and talk about your work in general. Although you work using a variety of media, your work always shares a common thread in that you somehow reference obscure and specific projects to important artists of the 1960s and 1970s, for the most part. Some examples you have referenced in one way or another include the Japanese conceptual artist An Kuwara during his 3-year stay in Mexico City, Daniel Berens' murals at a resort in the U.S. Virgin Islands, Boetti's proprietorship of a hotel called the One Hotel in Afghanistan. And in this, specifically what relates to your focus exhibition, Robert Smithson's projects in Texas. Can you talk about your work in general, how you relate to history and how you became interested in conceptual art?
Yeah. Hello. Good afternoon. Where should I start? I've had many responses to this, and I feel like, you know, from years to years, I kind of keep changing that answer, and I keep sort of negating myself, and then getting myself in more problems. But the latest response that I have to that is that when I started going to school, I first went to school in Monterrey, in a place in the north of Mexico, and back then I had this sort of I think now very naive and very stupid idea that was that I didn't want to share myself as a person. And I started thinking, like, how could I create a work of art that didn't involve myself as a person? And that was because I thought, you know, why would people care about my persona? What do I have to share in order to, like, for to be so important that people should care about? And not that I fully think that now I have anything interesting to say about my persona, but now I think I feel like my persona is more and more involved in the work. But back then I went through school, and in that school and sort of the people who were the main people who were sort of visible in Monterrey in museums and schools were mostly sort of people who still had a very kind of very romantic and very 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 bohemian notion of an artist, and most of them were kind of late abstract expressionist painters who cared about gesture and emotions and how do you express that in a canvas, and I was really like, that's not what I want to do. And not only that, but now I was in a big problem, which was how can I justify what I want to do. So early on, I think that question kind of coincided with the first revisions and the first publications that brought up conceptual art. And, you know, as some of you might know, that, you know, conceptual art from the 60s, I mean, from the late 60s, when those ideas, sort of conceptual ideas, were brought about, very few people saw the works. Very few people went to galleries and experienced those works firsthand. And in the early 90s or mid 90s, it was the time when people started reviewing that. And I feel like I am part of a generation that got where the first, we were young when those revisions were happening. So basically I spent a lot of time in the library, and suddenly I discovered this thing called conceptual art, and I thought, you know, this is great, because then I can go back to my professors and say, look at this stuff, and so I could sort of justify what I wanted to do through that. So lately I started thinking that maybe that sort of started my interest, and I feel like throughout the years what I've been really doing is trying to find sort of mind-like people, like even people who might be not around anymore, people who might have lived in a different time, people who I might have not even been able to do, but in a way, through the work and through research, I've been trying to identify myself with that. And I feel like that's sort of my interest in research and researching those sort of stories that sometimes are not told in history books are what brings me to them. So I don't know if that's a response.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about this project?
You mean the Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm.
This project was about
can you back up and talk about the inspiration that led to this project?
Yeah. I mean, this is a piece. It's a project that sort of generated a number of works that little by little. It's a kind of research that sort of went through, I don't know, a number of years, 7-8 years, little by little. I was researching on the fact one specific piece of information that intrigued me very much, which was the fact that Alighiero Boeria, an artist from the 70s, from the Povera Italian movement, had a hotel in the 70s in Afghanistan. And from many years, I read this line that said that. But information never got much farther than that. There was a couple of lines that said that the hotel was in a street named Chicken Street, and that he had a partner, and it never went farther than that. So I was really curious, and I feel like a lot of my interest in history is also about, not necessarily about the characters themselves, but about how sort of a kind of mythological figure came about. How does history is constructed, how history is played, and how those figures and those stories become a canonical thing, and why do we have this kind of intrigue? And of course, I discover many things throughout. And so, but the
so not on Allison's question, sorry. About this project.
Yeah, exactly. So now I'm going to start. No, I need to answer your question. And when I started the project, really, it was because I was actually living in California in the United States, and I was very much in disagreement with the war that was happening in Afghanistan. And I felt like in a very weird position to think, how can I say something about this, but at the same time being an immigrant in this country? And so at some point I figure out that in a very poetic term, I could talk about that situation through the story of Boeti in Afghanistan. So the first piece I made around this thing was actually a film treatment that pretended to describe a story where I was going to Afghanistan, and I was looking for the one hotel that actually the actual artist, Alighiero Boeti, had said that it had exploded. So the idea of disappearance and the idea of a faraway place sort of took about, and I tried to sort of describe how even the reasons for a war had disappear throughout the years and throughout the war. So anyway, it's a very long story, and which ended up in me actually after 7 years actually realizing that very same treatment script I had written in the US. And I went to Afghanistan, it was because I got invited to Documenta, and Documenta had the specific institutions to manage to have somebody actually go to Afghanistan, look for the place, and we found the place. And not only that, but we took over the place, and for a year we restored it, and I invited people from Afghanistan to come to the hotel, and I told why I thought this place was important for me and why it was important for Western history. And when the show in Germany, Documenta, finished, we released and gave back the house to its owner so that it could sort of continue its own history. Mm-hmm. So it was a way to figure out my, I feel like the last and most important gesture to me in that sense was how to took over and recognized it through caring about a place, which something interesting happened to me, and then releasing it again to be part of history again, to a different history.
Mm-hmm. Mario, I feel like when somebody asks you about one of your projects, you always insert the line, "It's a very long story." Would you say that's pretty much the case?
Yeah,
it certainly has been with us.
Yeah. I mean, I should first introduce you. Actually,
no, it's okay. This keep going. We'll talk about me later.
What am I going to say? No, I should
go for it.
You're going to move on to something. Well, to directly move on to your project here, which came out of an early collaboration with JD, your focus exhibition here at the Modern specifically relates to Robert Smithson and his projects in Texas. Smithson is arguably best known for the Spiral Jetty, which is seen here. It's a 1,500-foot-long spiraling landmass that jettisons out into the Great Salt Lake. During the time Robert Smithson made the Spiral Jetty, he also worked on two lesser-known projects in Texas, plans for the DFW airport, which were never realized, and also the Amarillo ramp, which was realized after his death as he died in a plane crash while surveying the site in preparation for the piece. So I just kind of wanted to ask you what first drew you to Smithson and specifically Smithson's projects in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, that long story started really some years ago, and that story came about because at some point, I don't know how much time ago, but at some point I realized that, I mean, I had read Smithson, and of course I very much appreciate a lot of his work and his writings mainly, and at some point I realized that in every picture, again, like the same way that Boetti had intrigued me in that sort of faraway adventure, I thought Smithson also sort of history had been written in a kind of similar way in that sense, in the fact that Smithson was a character that was an artist from New York, or that mainly lived in the art world, in the New York art world, but nevertheless was always going to a faraway place, going to the desert to do his work. And of course, he became very one of his most important proposals in our history is the fact that he was doing work outside in the land, and sort of, you know, became important in that. How he constructed what later became known as Langnard. And not only I was appreciated that, but the fact that he was always sort of creating a very specific character, or history had built a specific character, which was this cowboy going out in the land. So most when you look at Smithson's photographs, you see that he's wearing a cowboy hat and a pearl snap shirt, and so very early on I started thinking that, well, that story of an artist going out to the West, and not only that, but actually dying in his doing his work almost like a soldier, I started asking myself, how could I tell this story, and how could I retell this story where that says something. So I started writing a lyrics to potentially make that a country song. And that's when I met J.D. Wittenberg, which we have here. And at some point, somebody invited me in Dallas to participate in an exhibition. And I said, well, what I think could be have any kind of resonance in Dallas could be this thing that I think should be produced in Dallas. I have no idea how to make a country song, but I have these lyrics which could potentially become my collaboration to this exhibition at Dallas Biennial. I started talking to the curator, and through Erin Cluley, which is here with us, and we ended up talking to JD, which should get a better introduction. But before that, I should say that it was very important for me when I when I started doing that, to figure out not only the fact that I was talking about Smithson and talking about Texas, but also thinking that I needed somebody local to translate my thoughts. And I feel like that was, I should say that JD, we collaborated a lot in sort of shaping up the lyrics of the song, which he ended up singing and producing musically and composing. But the fact that I feel like my artistic gesture was really to figure out the way to tell a story to a specific people through their own subjectivity. How could I go to a place and check in with somebody who knows the language and tell him, listen, I have this story to tell. How could we collaborate to make it? How could you translate that into that very specific song? And I feel like that's precisely why I have invited JD here tonight, which is the fact because I sort of wanted to touch base again after a number of years and say, JD, now I have a show which continues this story and which we can talk later, but the fact that I need you again to come and translate that and translate each other for this in this context. And that's why I've asked JD to be here. I'm very honored that you're here.
Thanks, Mario. It's nice to be here with Mario. We've had a good time working together over the years. And just to be clear, the music that we worked on is a part of the film and the exhibition that's here this week. Mario, I think what impressed me the most is, songwriting is often differentiated from art. But what we do is very personal. At least what I do as a songwriter is very personal. And so when I was approached with the challenge of working with Mario on this project, I didn't realize it at the time what was happening. But I accepted the challenge because I thought it was interesting. Looking back now and looking at Robert Smithson, and I'm going to assume that there's a baseline knowledge of Robert Smithson with this crowd, but disregarding that, I'm going to go back a little bit and just say Smithson would take. He started out regionally. He would. New Jersey is a beautiful state. It's not the Garden State for no reason. And he would, he and his wife would load up these, objects, boulders, sand, what have you, from various parts of the state, bring them back to the galleries and create these non-sites, as he called them. And I have to admit, initially I thought that was kind of a bogus concept. But in working with Mario, I realized kind of after the fact that what in fact he did was create a non-site in our first iteration of this project together. And what that entailed was Mario coming to me with his concept. So these are the materials that he had to use for his non-site, right? It was Mario's concept. It was a general description of the musical, how he wanted it to sound. He did come with some lyrics or, an outline of how he wanted the song to, what he wanted to say. And that included some biographical information about Robert Smithson, his works, as much as possible, geographic locations, specifically Amarillo, New Jersey, Passaic, and New York City, and ultimately the way he passed away. So as a musician, singer, songwriter who tends to write from personal experience, this was a unique challenge, and I, the way it took shape was we very definitely collaborated on this song. He was in, thank God for modern technology, or this would have taken 10 years. We were IMing back and forth about every line, And there was a bit of education going on both sides. I would say much more on my side than on his. But there were certain nuances about country music, that sort of thing. So the way this installation initially took shape was a very simple record player placed inside an empty room, and the song playing on a vinyl record. And looking back, I can honestly say that Mario created a non-site right within the room, almost his own Amarillo ramp or spiral jetty, if you will. That all you had to do is, it was as part of this Biennale exhibit, travel to this location, and you could hear it. You could hear it throughout the building. It didn't really interfere with the other works, but you could, something was beckoning you to this corner, and you got into the room, and there it was the song. So it wasn't so much about me or the song, but it was about Mario and his vision and what he had to say about Smithson. And so what we're here to discuss tonight is about how he's extended and amplified that original piece and his vision to something much broader and something much more kind of along the lines of conceptual art and visual art and visual storytelling.
Yeah, so just to sort of explain what really JD has started to say is the fact that the exhibition here in the museum, it's that. So it's the project that took many years, and it's a long story. started from a song.
Always.
And at some point after some time, I figured that I wanted this song to become part of a larger project. So I ended up last year, I think, ended up making a film, which actually became a sort of road trip, a kind of essay film about the projects that Smithson had planned to do throughout the state of Texas and in the Amarillo Ramp, which is the only work that actually exists in Texas from Smithson and was made after his death. And the exhibition there has a number of elements, but nevertheless, it was very important to invite JD to sort of try to come back to the lyrics, because in a way, I feel like the way that was laid out little by little sort of started to sort of bring about a number of interests that became later on the film and a number of things. One of the other important things to say about the exhibition is the fact that in a way the film claims that even though Smithson never got to realize his visions in the state of Texas, the film claims that they actually exist. And how could we? So the exhibition really is kind of an essay about sort of arguing about that, arguing the fact that the works exist outside the museum. The works exist because they are thoughts independently. Where are they made, or not independently of where they made, but the fact that even though to think about the fact that if there is an idea and there is a place and there is a material still around, we could potentially experience those thoughts, and would that lead us to think farther, starting from Smithson thoughts. So that's really what the exhibition is about. But I don't know, maybe we should, do you happen to have the lyrics of...
JD's song, too, was heard as we all
you said
came
you
into
had
the auditorium.
The lyrics somewhere.
I do, in fact, have the lyrics. we debated whether or not you all, you know, we should bring the lyrics into this, because this isn't about, this is about the current work and about the cinematic duplicity that Smithson himself brought to New York. I mean, the Spiral Jetty is in Salt Lake, Utah, right? But he had to bring that back to New York. And in a way, I would say that's very much what what Mario is doing with the Amarillo Ramp and the exhibition that he has debuting this week. But with that, I'll be very happy to read the lyrics. I do have them, of course. We debated whether or not to read them. You heard the song coming in, and so I would just say about that. So Mario was very specific in his direction. He said he wanted it to sound country. And then I was like, okay, he was like, truck driver, country. And then we kind of dug a little deeper, Amarillo, truck driver, country. So that is my interpretation, our interpretation of Amarillo, truck driver, country, a lot of pedal steel, fiddle, what you heard coming in tonight. But I mentioned earlier, I kind of felt, looking back, the materials that were provided to me were, not working in the autobiographical information of a conceptual artist into a country song. Go. Okay. I do not come from this world. I don't know what you're talking about. Glue pour, right? Mirrors over a crystal lake. This sounds like I get it, but at the same time, I'm not sure I'm buying in. But it didn't matter, right? At the time, the challenge was to write a country song around that. I will say I've come around, thanks to Mario.
You should sing it.
There's a grand piano in the back. I don't know that it would give the same feel. If you want to get a feel for the collaborative partnership that Mario and I have developed, be sure and check out the Moderns Instagram account when you leave here. I think you'll be amused. So I'm going to read this. I'm going to read it a bit like Robert Frost read his poems, though I'm not Robert Frost and this isn't a poem, right? But what I want you to be looking for are places, biographical information about Smithson and his works. And with that, here I go. So again, this is a collaborative effort and, a song. The reason I didn't want to read it is because a song is not a song without the music. Typically, it turns into a kind of a bad poem. There's a difference. Poems are written with a certain lyric and tempo and rhythm in mind, and songs have the music to carry that. But so enough. I read it. As we downed a bottle at the end of the bar, he told me of his life and all about his art. He'd come so far to capture the West, to drag it back east to an exclusive set. He would look for lakes of crystalline salt with mirrors and lenses to reflect it all. Born in North Jersey with a drifter's smile, a camera around his neck, and a killer smile. To shape the land, he took to the air. His faith would return him back down again. He talked about jetties and glue he had poured. He sculpted the land and left the dirt on the floor. His pearl snaps reflected in the Amarillo lights. Though from different worlds, we were friends that night. While 73 saw the kind of drought that turns rocks to dust and lays good men out. Some days you make the work, and other days it makes you. And it's hard to tell when to know which one is true. It's just one of life's little secrets I wish I knew. The years had left me in a different place and time, but the news on the radio struck me blind. The DJ said it happened so fast. The fireball I met had recently crashed on an isolated stretch of I-95. I saw Passaic spread across the sky. I thought about my old friend and wished we could talk. But after last night, Bob was gone, gone, gone. So there you have it. You have Passaic, you have the East, you have the West, you have his works. And to hear me say it may not be as effective as to hear what you heard when you walked in. But, I think again, getting back to the reason why we're here and what you'll see at the Modern, is, you know, that song again has new life in this short film, and it's really nice the way you did it. So maybe we should talk about the film.
Yeah, I mean, it's very important to it's funny to hear you speak the lyrics, because I mean, there's so many layers.